Hello and welcome to Book Bites. This show is a book club for developers where the four of us come together and talk about a book we've all been reading and discuss it with one another. This week, actually, it's only three of us because Jen is too sick to knit. This week, we're discussing chapters 3 and 4 of Apprenticeship Patterns by Dave Hoover and Ade Oshinea. And we're also giving away 5 signed copies of the book. So head over to orbit.fm/bookbites/giveaway to enter to win that. I'm Adam Garrett Harris.
I am Sophia.
I'm Jason Staten.
So this week we're going over chapters 3 and 4 of Apprenticeship Patterns. But first I want to see if you have anything from last time where we went over chapters 1 and 2 that you wanted to talk about.
I did have something. It was actually a bit of an introspective moment for me. And it kind of related to something that was said in the text as well. So I think last time we were talking about some of the lessons that were outlined in a particular chapter, and I said something to the effect of, oh, I thought most of these were like really obvious. And then I was kind of going back and just thinking about the conversation we had and all of the different ideas that were flowing. And one of the lessons that were kind of highlighted in chapter 2, emptying the cup, I realized that that comment was kind of indicative of some of the behavior that was highlighted in that chapter, which is kind of coming into a situation with a lot of preconceived ideas and assumptions. And then I kind of sat back and I was like, oh wow, I should have definitely tried emptying my cup a little bit more before I read that chapter and maybe been more open to some of the ideas that were in it. So that was just a realization I had where I realized that I hadn't completely internalized one of the lessons that was in the chapter.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's kind of meta to empty your cup before you read the chapter about emptying your cup.
Yeah.
I think that that's one of the reasons why I think early in this book it talks about being able to have just the patterns, because they apply again in different situations. And so, I mean, the first situation, you reading it fresh, was probably you reflecting back on previous experiences. But then you going and reading it again was reflecting back on your experience after reading the chapter. And so, I mean, that itself is the practical purpose of rereading these patterns and seeing how they apply.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jason.
So for me, one of the things that I thought about and actually put into action, or at least got rolling at work, is my team that I work with. I'm the technical lead over them, and one of the things that I wanted to do was start a bi-weekly technical discussion. And part of that was putting out a survey to say, hey, what are the things that we don't know about at the company, or what are black boxes to us? And so that was one of the ways I actually went and said, I'm going to expose my ignorance as well as confront it, to say, I don't know these things about my job, and I will find out what those things are, as well as if somebody else on the team doesn't know what that is, I will attempt to do some of the digging to find out what that thing means, because there are plenty of things that are unknowns to me.
Nice. Yeah. Expose your ignorance is one of my favorite pattern in that chapter.
I hope that it will work out over time. And I'm sure, I mean, I'll come out at least having interacted with more people within the company or more developers that work on things that are unknown to me. So to go along with some of the things that we've covered in these upcoming chapters we're going to talk about, that maybe find some, whether it's mentors or kindred spirits along the way.
Yeah, so one of the things from last time that I did is the retreat into competence pattern. So I've been building the website for this podcast, and some of it's new technology, but I just realized as I was making it, how much faster and better I am at it than the last time I made a website. It's been a while since I made a kind of simple website, and it's just very refreshing to see how much more easily it comes and how much better I am.
There's definitely value in going, and I know that sometimes recreating a blog or a website can just be churning, but also at the same time, there is that satisfaction, because I've definitely seen you cranking away at stuff in the GitHub. I commend you for that effort, Adam.
Thanks. Okay, so what about chapter 3?
So one of the things that struck out to me was about the first section of this chapter, which is titled The Long Road. And it's just kind of about kind of envisioning your career on a long-term basis. And the comment that stuck out to me about it actually appeared a little bit later in the chapter, just a couple of pages after. And it's this quote that I pulled out. It's on page 46 for anybody following. And it goes something like this. The people who walk the long road are not the heroes who sprint for a few years and burn out. They're the people moving at a sustainable pace for decades. And that quote really struck with me just because I feel like oftentimes I am the person who sprints for a few years and burns out, or I have a personality that makes me susceptible to that particular characteristic. So when I read that quote, it just really hit me. I was like, whoa, I can see myself in this quote, and I can kind of understand the value it's presenting in choosing a sustainable pace for decades versus just working really fast and really hard for a few years and then just totally fizzling it out at the end.
I think that it's really key that you mentioned that you recognize that about yourself, Safiya, that you know that you can get yourself into a position of potentially burning out. And noticing that about yourself before it actually happens is definitely a good way to prevent long-term detriment.
Yeah.
Yeah, so one of the things this chapter talks about is making a plan to be a software craftsman for your entire life rather than moving into management or some other role where you're doing less coding. What did you think about that? Because a lot of people see that as the goal, to become a manager or a CTO.
Yeah, that was a really interesting section to read for me. At the moment, I'm actually interviewing for my first post-college career. So I've been talking to a ton of different companies. And usually one of the first things they ask me are, you know, what is your long-term career goal? And my answer is generally, you know, I want to be in management and leadership. That's where I feel most comfortable, just based on some of the experiences I had with leading things in open source and in other places. And so when I read that particular section, The Long Road, and was like, oh, you know, plan to be a software craftsman or craftwoman on a long-term basis, I was like, huh, this doesn't really align with the career trajectory that I've chosen for myself. And I kind of sat and thought about it for a little bit. And I was like, you know, to be a software craftsman or craft person, does it have to be your career? Can you be somebody who is in management as like your day-to-day job, but the kind of craft of software development is something that you do in your off time with open source work or just side projects or things like that? And that just kind of started to make me think a little bit about how flexible the definition of a craft person is in this case. Does it have to be your job? Does it have to be something you commit to X number of hours a week? Like, who is this label open to, basically? Did that make any sense?
Yeah. And there's also the patterns in here of draw your own map or a different road.
Yeah.
Which, you know, draw your own map means not everyone's path looks the same. And a different, I think it's called a different road, means not everyone has to be a programmer for life. And that's totally okay.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And you can define it for yourself, like you were saying.
As well, it does mention that is the focus of this book. So it's not necessarily even in a form of it's the one way. Like you said, drawing your own map and finding the way that you progress in your craft. And I guess I would say that even having had a touch in management, only because it was a small startup company, it is nice to get the exposure and the context there. But I mean, you may be filling that role, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're out of the craft or that you're not able to grow your skills there. But actually, I think having that context can sometimes just be you in a leader role for a period of time as well.
Yeah.
So for me, that section talking about trying to be a programmer for as long as you can, rather than taking a management role just because it's promotion and more money, was actually really comforting to me, because that's what I want to do. And I felt like I was supposed to eventually move into management. And the fear was that if I'm an old programmer, no one's going to want to hire me because they think I'm old and my skills are out of date.
I think it does kind of continue to go on to talk about ways that you can ensure that too, or even some of the earlier crafts of retaining concrete skills and remaining relevant. Because I think where you can really get caught up in the old programmer ageism issues is when you just get yourself stuck on a single tech or something and don't want to change from there because you know enough from where you're at, or you think you know enough from where you're at.
Yeah, I think earlier in the book it talked about craftsmanship versus like being a craftsman versus being an expert. And an expert is just good at only one thing, and that's the only thing they know how to do. And if that thing becomes out of date, then they're kind of irrelevant. So yeah, I like how this book constantly pushes you to, hey, you think you're a journeyman? Well, have you done this on multiple platforms? How about learning a new language?
It also talks too that says, if you're still going to be working in 20 years' time, then you can do anything. And even people that we look up to, like Donald Knuth and Linus Torvalds, like their set of skills are attainable by us in 20 years of time, because that is a ton of time. But also keeping in mind that they're continuing to go forward too.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, as both of you have kind of been in the industry for a little while, when you started off your software engineering career with your first job, did you have a chance to sit and create like a long-term roadmap for where you wanted to be? Or what was the experience like for figuring out what your experience in tech was going to look like?
I didn't really map it out, and I felt really inadequate for a long time. I didn't have a mentor, and I kind of stumbled into being a front-end developer because I started off as full stack, and then my second job, I was hired as a PHP developer and ended up not writing a single line of PHP at that job. I did all JavaScript. And then that led me to a really good job at Domo as a front-end developer, where I felt like I really could hone my craft and rub elbows with a lot of really great developers. Now I feel like I'm at a point where I can and should map out at least some ideas, right? Like this book doesn't say you make concrete plans. One of the exercises is you write down several possible job roles, and then on each of those other ones that you could go to from there, and then it keeps branching out to all these different possibilities. I'm starting to do that. I'm starting to think I should pick up some more languages, some back-end stuff. I want to be more diversified now.
What was the experience like for you, Jason?
So I guess I could agree that I wasn't a long-term planner through starting out my career. I guess I interviewed on and like accepted a job offer on a Friday and then like started work the following Monday. And so I just got dropped into it and actually went into a company where when I started, the people around me were really brilliant. And I mean, we're going to jump into it more following chapter where it talks about being the weakest person on the team. And I certainly felt like that coming in, questioning why am I getting paid this much? I don't even know why I'm here. And because I was put on a team that had two people in particular that I felt were kind of mentors for me that really pushed me to level up, I was able to come out feeling like I did know what I was doing a bit more. And when I left that company, I actually switched to go to a small startup where there was one other developer and I think five people total in the company at the time. And the other developer eventually left. And so I led up development there on my own and kind of helped build the company and roll it along. And so I got the flip exposure of not having an like internal company mentor, but I did get the exposure of having a big title of chief architect and got to do everything from systems management all the way up to designing on the front end. And I know that the only reason that I was successful there was because of my prior mentorship. Even though it wasn't necessarily formalized, it was rubbing elbows with those people in particular that pushed me through that. And then pendulum kind of swung back, and I'm at Domo at the moment, and I'm now with a much larger company, and am trying to kind of progress myself as a multiplier for developers that are there. So instead of only being focused on producing features, which is a typical day-to-day goal for helping the company succeed, I also aim to be, I guess, personally satisfied by helping other people in the company improve. And so that's, I guess, it hasn't really been charted out super well, and this book has made me reflect on that. I think I need to get a little bit more concrete on some of that, just to make sure that I am following a line that, or a trajectory that I will wind up in a place that I really do want to be. But so far, that's been my path.
Yeah. So it seems from hearing both of your stories that it's kind of striking the balance early on with like going with the flow and then kind of trying to channel that flow into some sort of loose roadmap.
Yeah. I mean, at some point I realized I really love JavaScript. So that's what I wanted to go for. What about you?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, so it's so interesting for me because, well, I asked you for your experiences because I don't technically consider myself, this might be a terrible thing to say, but like a real software engineer. Since I haven't officially worked like full time in the industry at a 9-to-5 as a software engineer, I've done a lot of work in open source. I've worked at a ton of internships. I've freelanced a ton, but I've never actually like filed a W-2 as a software engineer, which just might be kind of, you know, an irrelevant distinction. But it is to say that I haven't really had the opportunity to stay at an organization for a really long time and develop the kinds of mentorships that are useful. I think the kind of tough thing with being like an apprentice in the literal sense, like some companies will have apprenticeships or internships, or just short-term employment opportunities, is you don't really get to lay down your roots anywhere. And although I've had a couple of people at the different organizations that I've worked for, that I've connected with, that still mentor me, not so much in the technical sense, but just kind of general life and career mentorship, I feel like I haven't really had the chance to join a team, work on a product for a really long time, and get the kind of hand-on-hand mentorship that you might get in a corporate environment. I think the closest I've gotten to it is in open source, where I've known people for like 3 years at a time and have had the chance to get mentorship from them, and have them kind of guide the road that I travel on with my career. So yeah, I guess I have had experiences where I've had kind of situations where I didn't really know where I wanted to go with my career, but I've had people help me, especially in open source. I think that's my version of a full-time job throughout my career as a college student, is I've done a lot of open source, and that's kind of where a lot of my experiences and insights come from. And they're a little different, I'm sure, from what you've experienced in kind of full-time jobs, but I think a lot of the stuff intersects, the lessons learned and the concepts. So I don't know if that answers your question. I'm still trying to figure out what my path looks like, so I don't have a completely solid answer.
Yeah,
I would say firstly, a paycheck does not determine if you are a developer or not. Savio, you're definitely a developer. I mean, being an open source contributor and being as active as you are in the community, I think you are definitely a developer. And so don't sell yourself short. I am impressed with your path.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it reminds me of a quote from the book that says, it's under the use your title section. It says, do not allow your title to affect you.
Yeah.
It is a distraction that should be kept on the outskirts of your consciousness. And if you're in an organization, then you can use that to gauge your organization rather than yourself. So like Jason, you were mentioning you were a chief architect, but that's a way to gauge your organization more than yourself. And so, Safia, as like, I don't know what you consider your title, student, open source contributor, whatever.
Yeah, that's been a great source of confusion for me over the past couple of years. Just because when you introduce yourself, everybody wants kind of what's your role? What company are you at? I'm just like, I'm not sure. I'm just here chilling. So,
yeah. And I think that's kind of a distraction because, like Jason said, you are a developer.
Yeah. So I have a question regarding the title thing for you folks.
Yeah.
Did you get the sense that at the particular organizations that you've worked with throughout your career, that titles did kind of have an outsized role in the way that people worked and interacted with each other? Was there kind of like the senior folks and the junior folks and distinctions in rank and management? Or do you feel like titles are not actually a big thing at the places that you've worked and the experiences you've had?
I don't think they're usually that big of a deal what your official title is. There's generally more a sense of a cultural title for people, a sense of cultural respect. Jason, when I was at Domo, you weren't a senior engineer, but I felt like you totally were. And yeah, you could just tell in the organization who's more junior, even if they have a normal title, or who's more senior, even if they have a normal title. And, you know, sometimes people move from normal to senior and you don't even know, but you still, it's still someone that people look up to.
I think I go along with that same vibe of it's, it doesn't particularly matter. I don't know what most titles of developers are that I work with, but kind of know that they are in a position of responsibility, maybe over a specific domain. I do know that externally, or at least on LinkedIn, sometimes titles matter a little bit, even if in the wrong way. For an example, previously when I was a chief architect, I once actually had a recruiter contact me about an actual architecture job of like building a building. And I told them that they had definitely picked the wrong person because using Agile for constructing bridges may be harmful. So there is a little bit of outward perspective, but definitely don't get too caught up on it. I think like the book kind of says, it kind of describes how you may be perceived in the organization, not necessarily by your peers, but by whether it be accounting or high up execs, if they don't have a individual relationship with you at the time. I think one thing that stood out to me, or one pattern I liked, it was the mentioning of craft over art, and saying that while we can produce really impressive things, like it's important to have the things that we make be useful. And it's not that we can't make things that are not useful. I mean, we can certainly make code pens that create amazing things in only CSS, but we should also have a focus of creating things for our customers, being potentially the companies that we work for, who we're producing things for, and making that fine, but always keeping the focus on having a use in what we ultimately create.
Yeah, I love this Richard Stallman quote at the beginning of the craft over art pattern. And he said, craft means making useful objects with perhaps decorative touches, and fine art means making things purely for their beauty. And it's kind of cool to me too, because my wife, she's in the last couple of years moved from a fine art background to a UX background, where she went from making things just for beauty's sake to actually making things that are useful for people.
I quite liked the point made in this chapter with respect that you sometimes have to produce satisfactory work or things that make your customers happy, even if you don't feel like it or if it doesn't rise to your standard. And I've definitely been experiencing that a lot with one of my side projects, of just having to kind of sit down and ship things to customers, even if it doesn't kind of look perfect or as good as I would like it to me. And I personally think that this might be one of my strongest patterns, or the pattern which I uphold the best. It's just kind of valuing making people happy with the code that I build versus satisfying my own engineer who needs things to look right or be efficient or be perfect. And I think that in large part stems from the fact that when I entered the field, and I think a lot of people who enter the field come in wanting to solve problems for people or to build apps to fix things or address issues. So I think that kind of using software to serve people makes it much easier to view it as a craft than an art.
Yeah. Yeah, this section reminds me of an article I was reading this week on CSS tricks by Sarah Drasner, and it's called The Art of Comments, and it's defending the use of comments because there's a lot of stuff out there saying your code should be so beautiful and elegant that you don't need to write any comments. And one of the reasons why she says you might want to write a comment is if you're in such a hurry, you have a lot of pressure to get something out there, and so you just get something that works. And you might want to write a comment that says something like, this isn't my best work, but we had to get it in by the deadline. And so that's cool to see that that's totally fine sometimes. There's value in getting it done for the customer.
Mm-hmm. I think there's the flip side of that too, of also being a responsible craftsman as well, of only hacking things together to get them out as quickly as possible. So if you find yourself writing lots of those comments, or if you find yourself seeing them as you are working on code, going back and taking the time to clean up some of that mess you may have made in order to ensure that your customer really stays happy, because you can continue to produce things quickly and you haven't coded yourself into a corner.
Yeah, totally. I think that's one of the reasons that you would write the comment is as a note to yourself that this is okay to refactor and should be refactored. Okay, so chapter 4 is called Accurate Self-Assessment. And actually, I don't have a good way of explaining how these patterns fit together.
So, I mean, it definitely leads off with the mentioning of potentially becoming a big fish in a small pond, or outgrowing the current situation you're in, and not allowing yourself to be comfortable with your skill set or your ability, and instead saying, yes, I've improved, but also seeing I can go further. And in order to do that, I need to take steps rather than just idling by in the current state I'm in.
Yeah, so the first pattern is be the worst, which you mentioned earlier, Jason. And I actually read this book right before leaving a really, really small company where I was basically one of two developers. So I was a big fish in a small pond, to Domo. And that was one of the big reasons why I wanted to go to Domo, because I knew that at a larger company, I would be surrounded by lots of talented developers. And I definitely felt like I was the worst there for quite a while, which was great. I got to learn a lot and grow a lot.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, Adam, because I actually brought this pattern up in a way during one of the job interviews that I had recently. They were kind of asking me, you know, what do you want out of a career, so on and so forth. And I was like, oh, you know, I want somewhere where I can be the worst. And I probably should have cited the book. But I kind of just explained to them a lot of what the book highlighted, and it kind of helped me see this by highlighting it, is that I definitely feel like my learning has stagnated at a certain point, just with the kind of open source work I've been doing lately and some of the work I've been doing from an academic sense and some of the personal side projects that I'm pursuing. And I was like, you know, I want a challenge to invigorate my learning in a place where I can be the least competent person and have to kind of catch up with everybody. So yeah, I'm also kind of using this pattern as I kind of transition into a career.
Yeah. One of the things I love about this pattern is just because you're the worst doesn't mean it makes you feel worse. It actually makes you feel better because everyone else is bringing you up.
Yeah, that's a great way to flip the perspective and look at it.
I think, too, your last line that you mentioned, Sophia, about making sure that you want to be the worst, but you want to catch up. That is the key part of this. Something that's mentioned in it is that when teams bring on somebody who is going to be the worst, that they are inherently taking on a risk. And the book actually makes a reference to Jamie Zawinski's resignation from Netscape, or kind of Mozilla at the time, or the Mozilla project at the time. And it's a pretty blunt paper. I actually enjoyed getting sidetracked and reading that, because it's called No Mozilla. But he specifically says there is a factor, or he talks about how Netscape was really innovative at the start of its time, and said that during the first few years, like, they revolutionized the world. I mean, they made a face to the internet, and then from 96 to 99, it was more of a coasting type of situation of the company. It wasn't continually improving. And they said that one of the factors involved is that you can divide our industry into two kinds of people: those who want to go work for a company to make it successful, and those who want to work for a successful company. And it was claiming that the latter was becoming more common at Netscape at the time, and essentially not bringing on people that are going to push themselves to keep up with the really strong developers there, and instead just saying, yeah, I'm here, I'm at Netscape, and I've made it, instead of having the perspective of, all right, I'm here, this company's done a lot of awesome stuff, but I want to push myself and this company further.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely one of the reasons that I've kind of focused a lot of my career search on small to mid-sized companies, just because I feel like they are in a better position to kind of employ or attract the kind of people who want to make a company successful and kind of have that drive and that innovative nature. And I would say it's really hard to find, like, that magic that Jamie talks about that was at Netscape when he was there, and that he felt kind of was lost, is really hard to find in a company. And I think that's what keeps you, as somebody who's hired as the worst, or somebody who's maybe less skilled than the other engineers, keeps you from staying in that position, is having some, like, magic to invigorate you and inspire you. So that's a pretty cool read.
I think one other quote from that that paper, along with the line of working for a smaller or mid-sized company, is, I mean, it's a kind of a bold statement, but it says, there are counter examples to this, but big companies just aren't creative. In general, great things are accomplished by small groups of people who are driven, who have unity of purpose. The more people involved, the slower and stupider their union is. And like I said, it's pretty blunt, but I could see the effect of that when you have a massive group of people all surrounding to come up with one interface for a modal or something like that. I've heard of developers who have been in that situation, and they are just, like, they can't handle it, because they're just stuck. Like, they're not moving forward. They're just, or feeling like they're making any real impact, and so they're not motivated.
Yeah, and I think that kind of connects with the kindred spirits pattern that was discussed in the book, which is essentially that you might find yourself in a position where you're stranded in an organization and you don't have any mentors. And I think despite the fact that large companies have more people, so that there's a bigger chance you might interact with somebody who will end up being a mentor, I don't think there's as much of an ability for there to emerge, like, the organic, friendly mentorships that you might find at smaller organizations that I think are much more fulfilling than kind of some of, like, the structured mentorship strategies they set up in larger companies and things like that.
I do definitely think it's important to get in contact with those outside, even for the influences that they can expose to you outside of your company's culture or its current tech stack. I had a personal experience with going to a Ruby group that was in Salt Lake, and one particular meeting that I was kind of blown away with is a guy came there, presented on Clojure, and he had this whole room full of Rubyists who were just ranting and raving about how they didn't like parentheses, and he held his own against the entire room about how he thought it was a beautiful language, and that it was, he was so productive in it because of reason X, Y, and Z. And that was enough to draw my interest even in the language to even look at it. And so by going and stretching myself outside of just the walls of the company, I was able to go and, you know, get a little bit of insight on that front. And while I don't necessarily write closure now, I did go and explore it and get the influence of it in my craft.
So I'm curious if y'all have had experience with the find mentors pattern, because it's saying here that it's exceptionally rare. It can be difficult to tell who's a master craftsman, and sometimes you have to scratch and claw your way into the lives of master craftsmen.
Yeah, my approach has always been, and maybe I need to rethink this, but my approach has been that most people in a senior position or with most experience or with more experience than me have perspective to offer and valuable mentorship. So I think I don't necessarily go out seeking master craftsmen to engage with in a, like a mentorship relationship. I'll just hear anybody out and pick and choose different ideas from different people. Yeah, I don't know how I feel about the scratch and claw your way into the lives of master craftsmen.
Yeah, and then it says you should be grateful for whatever you get.
Yeah, it feels a little, it kind of feels like it's promoting that like elitist heroism bit that kind of exists in tech.
Yeah, I see a lot of people complain on Twitter that people will ask to meet up with them and not explain why. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest complaint. I think a lot of people are open to meeting with people and open to mentoring, but you need to be more specific about what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Stephanie Hurlburt on Twitter posted something pretty recently about reaching out to people in a networking way. And she actually posted some really nice examples. I'll pass the link over to you, Adam. But it gave examples of ways to email or tweet at somebody to say, hey, I want to meet up. Here's why I want to meet up. And are you available at this time? And most people, I mean, if you keep it short and to the point, they might read it. And as the book says, that the risk of being rejected is like flat out rejected and saying, no, I don't want to help you at all is pretty low. And even if it does happen, the payoff of it can be huge. Even if you can get a short moment of somebody's time, not even necessarily being a master, but rather anybody that you want to learn from or gain perspective from, reaching out to them can only, like, you either get the value in it or you're in the same place that you're at.
I'm curious to know, have you ever been in situations where you have had to reach out to somebody that you considered a master craftsman for advice or mentorship? And how did that experience go for you? Like, how did you reach out to them? Did they respond? What did the relationship end up positive? I can share one if you want to take some time to think about it.
Okay,
please.
Go ahead.
So this happened the summer after my freshman year of college. I was interning in San Francisco, and I had gone to Dropbox for some hackathon they were doing just for the interns in town. And my team ended up winning like second or third place at the hackathon. And I decided to use that win as an entry point to get a meeting with Guido von Rossum, who's the creator of the Python programming language.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was so nerve-wracking for me. It was one of the first times in my life that I'd ever, like, emailed a big deal person for something. And so I just sent him an email. I said, hey, I was at Dropbox's offices a couple of weeks ago for an event. You weren't there. I was wondering if you wanted to grab lunch. I'd love to know your experiences building the Python programming language because I'm interested in building programming languages. Next, he responded. He was like, sure. And it ended up being me and the teammates from the hackathon, and we had a great lunch with him. The one thing that I did going into the lunch was actually write down, well, not actually write down, but think up a list of questions that I wanted to ask him. And so I had the opportunity to, you know, show him that I wasn't wasting his valuable time. And we kept a pretty great conversation going, and I got to learn a ton of interesting things about his experiences building Python and the language that he tried to build before Python. That was kind of like the precursor in just the early days of Python. So that was the one experience I had. And I think the one thing that I got out of that with respect to how you reach out to people is just be very specific and kind of enthusiastic and curious. So that was a really cool and fun experience.
Yeah. Jason, do you have any experience with that?
So I would say my closest experience to that would be at the first company that I worked at. We adopted the web framework FUBU MVC, which is just a C# alternative to Microsoft's ASP.NET. And it was a really different approach to building out web software. And when we adopted it, it was 0.1 or 0.2, really early in its life cycle. The developer who had created it, Jeremy Miller, was a very impressive mind to interact with. And because it was so early on, there was a lot of open source back and forth in getting his perspective on how things worked. And it was enlightening to have him be able to do things like review a code contribution that I had made and give a better approach for handling the problems that I was working on. And just really having somebody who understood things like design patterns from Gang of Four really well. Like, he could go and look at a problem and say, yeah, that's actually a fit for the visitor pattern. And that's not something that I myself generally find myself thinking of. But actually, he wrote an excellent blog post that I was able to refer back to because he was one of the ones that made me understand that. And so while it wasn't a direct me asking to meet directly with him, but through the open source exposure, I was able to be in contact with him. And actually, shortly after I left the company, they hired him on at the company that I was at. So I was like, just barely missed rubbing elbows with him, but did in the long distance sense.
Cool. Yeah. So when I first moved to Utah, I realized there were all these meetup groups here about all sorts of programming languages and things. It was the first time I was in an area with a big tech scene. And so I just started going to as many meetups as possible. And one of the meetups was just, you would get together and you would work on your side projects, just kind of all in the same room. And you could ask each other questions, help each other out. And so I remember there was a guy there who was a technical co-founder of a startup. And he looked over my code a little bit one time, just a few seconds, really, and helped me figure something out. And we connected on Twitter. And I remember he said one time that I had some technical chops. And that felt really good to hear him say that. That really motivated me to keep going as a craftsman.
I think that's something we could just in general use more in the field is praising of each other, of our accomplishments.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I saw a tweet by David Walsh that was something to the effect of, nobody thrives on low self-confidence, so do your best to boost each other up in pull request reviews and things like that. I thought that was a really great tweet and kind of was along the same point that you were trying to make, Jason.
Yeah, I try to use a lot of positive emojis in my comments on GitHub and in tweets, because it's really hard to tell the inflection of the person when it's just text. So the thumbs up and the ta-da and the clapping emoji, I use those liberally. So I really like the sweep the floor pattern, which is, you're new to a team, you're kind of trying to prove yourself, you want to make some sort of useful contribution and prove your worth. And so, yeah, I always find it useful when there's someone joining a team, or if I'm the person joining the team, where you're not really familiar with the code base, right? You're just kind of looking at it and trying to get familiar with it at first, but you can at least with fresh eyes look at things and fix some little CSS things or upgrade a dependency or update the README or update the onboarding documentation. I just love this pattern. It's something that you should definitely be aware of when you're joining a new team.
Yeah. That's something that I've employed a lot, especially when I'm trying to join a new open source project. One of the common tips you get is, you know, just pick the low-hanging fruit. or easy to solve issues in the project and address them. So this is actually a pattern that applies really, really well in open source. The one place that I've struggled with it personally is making sure that I don't stagnate and become just the person who sweeps the floor all the time. Just because I feel like I've definitely been in situations where I have kind of been the person who takes on small tasks and upgrades and things like that. And then people just like piled those kinds of things on me, even though I probably was capable of doing things much more complex than that. So I think it's kind of a tough balance between, you know, sweeping the floor to get your foot in the door, but also making sure that you're not permanently doing that.
I think that there's value in trying to get that part of the culture of your team as well, that those small tasks that are maybe put on the side because of other more pressing priorities, that they, once again, we kind of going back to the praise thing, that they are celebrated too, where if somebody goes and makes your test suite run twice as fast because they took out all your timeouts or sleeps or whatever and made everything still work, or they just generally improve the project, making sure that that's a thing that the team you're on is concerned with. And so it's less of a thing when you're brand new on it. You may not have necessarily that influence, but I guess when you are more experienced on a team or you've been on it longer and there are newer people, also being willing yourself to go back and do the floor sweeping thing and say that it's not above everybody and that when others do it, praising them, but also allowing yourself to step back and do it. So you are allowing other people to step up, kind of like it mentions in the finding mentorship is when first you're searching for mentors when you're new, but you also have the responsibility to help others level up. And I think part of that is recognizing if there are people on your team that are stuck in that role or happen to only be picking up smaller things, to give them something a little bit bigger, let them jump off the deep end and let them try their hand at something a little larger.
Yeah, I think it's the responsibility of people more experienced on the team suggesting bigger items for new people. Yeah. And I think just saying, yeah, I think you can do this will give them more confidence to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also liked what you said about praising within your team those little sweeping the floor tasks, because those aren't providing any business value. No customer is going to notice. No executive is going to notice. Your manager may not even notice or praise that, but it's still important.
And I think, too, I don't know if you spent a lot of time on the nurture your passion part, but sweeping the floor can definitely help with that, too. If you're on something that's a slog to deal with for one reason or another, that by doing some of that cleanup work and making everybody's lives easier as developers, that can personally improve your motivation. I mean, the test suite example that I gave, there was another member on my team that did improve our test suite runtime pretty dramatically, to the point that other people do want to write tests on the project now, where previously they didn't because they took so long to write and run.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's cool. Okay, so anything else in this chapter?
No, I think we got to the end.
Cool. Yeah, I like at the very end, it wraps it up by talking about humility versus ambition, mm-hmm. or not really versus, but both of those things are good. You want to have ambition, but also be humble.
Wise words.
So what are some action items that you want to work on that we'll talk about next week?
So I would say one thing that I might end with is like maybe an action item for myself even to take out of this, just so I can have some accountability. So for me, I would say that I would probably like to try the suggestion at finding a mentor or taking the approach of reaching out to somebody who maybe intimidates me a little bit or I'm intrigued by their work, and set up some sort of discussion with them, whether it be a Skype call or something. So within the next time period before our next recording, I definitely, I think I will set myself a goal to do that, and I will follow up next week or next episode.
Okay.
So I've actually been really in the zone with a lot of the patterns that we picked up in the last episode of this podcast. And one of the things that I've been diving to a lot is jumping into the deep end. More recently, I've been finding ways to push my learning forward in just kind of like really aggressive, high-speed ways. And it's been very fun just to jump off the plateau and go into a complete free fall and also blog about going into that free fall and what I'm learning. So that's just something I want to continue doing is jumping off the deep end and trying in, continuing to try out difficult problems.
So one thing that I want to do is under sustainable motivations, it says to write down a list of things that motivate you. Write down like a list of 20 things and then narrow it down to 5. So I really want to do that because I tend to burn out based on what my motivations are. And so I need to find some motivations that are really sustainable.
I look forward to hearing that list.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be discussing chapters 5-7 next time, and then we'll be chatting with author Dave Hoover. Don't forget to enter to win one of the signed books over at orbit.fm/bookbite/giveaway. The instructions there will ask you to leave a review on iTunes. And I actually just wanted to read a review really quickly. We've got a review from username Base64. Excited to see this happen. Looking forward to future episodes. So thank you so much, Base64, for listening and leaving that review. I hope that this is a useful podcast for you. You can follow the show on Twitter at BookBitesFM, and you can find the show notes and transcript for this episode at orbit.fm/bookbites/3. See you next time.